Accession number 27347, Reel 1.
Stanley Van, Reel 1. Stanley, can you tell me where and when you were born, please?
I was born in a little village called Teesville, outside Middlesbrough, in 1923. My parents, dad had been in the army, mother was a teacher. They met when dad was operating searchlights down in Surrey, and my mother came from a family of nine who'd lost their father when he was 42, so that they'd had a pretty rough time of it. The family story is that Granny used to invite people round from the local army depot to get her daughters married off, and that's what happened.
Do you have any brothers or sisters?
Yes, one brother, one sister. A brother who's older than me. He was born in 1919. And a sister younger than me, born in 1928.
And what was the family home like?
Very loving, very warm, very close, with lots of principles. A father who, in my eyes, never put a foot wrong. A mother who worked her fingers to the bone to see that her little brood were looked after.
And what did your father do for a living?
He was an engineer. He served his time as a fitter and turner with Smith Docks up in North Shields. But he was born in 1892, so that when the First World War broke out, he was 22. He was in the Volunteers, the equivalent of the Territorials, so that he went away on the outbreak of war in the Royal Engineers. And he went to the kite and balloon section of the Royal Engineers, where down in Gosport, that's where he started. He ended up in France and on the Italian-Austrian frontier. He got around, but he also got gassed. He was mentioned in dispatches twice, but he was a wreck at the end of the war with the gassing. In fact, when he died in 1960, his death certificate said, I forget exact wording of it, but it was accelerated by gassing. So it had stayed with him all that time.
What about your education?
I had an education at the local primary school, Cromwell Road School, in South Bank near Middlesbrough, which was a hard school. It was in a depressed and deprived area, although we didn't know we were deprived. It was a very tough area because there was so much unemployment. In fact, in my class at school, during the summer, there were only about six of us with shoes on our feet. In winter, it was a class of 56. In winter, there might be 50 of us with shoes on our feet, but six without shoes, with chilblains on their feet. At 4 o'clock, when school finished, there was a rush amongst the children to get down to the Smith Dockyard gates, or to Cargo Fleet exit gates, or to Dorman Long's exit gates, and they'd stand there saying, "Any bread left, mister?" Because if there were no canteens in those days, the men always took their bait to work, in sandwiches, and if there was any left over, it wasn't wasted. The kids got it, that the men came out of work.
What was the main industries around there that were the problem in employment?
The only industries were shipbuilding at Smith Docks, steel rolling mills at Cargo Fleet and Dorman Longs. They were about the only industries there were, except for the catering industries. People lived off the income from those main three, which meant that when the Depression came, about 1925, it was very badly hit because there was very little shipping, just tramp steamers. There was very little demand for iron and steel, except for major things like the Sydney Harbour Bridge, but they came through very few and far between. So there was terrible unemployment. My father was unemployed for about 2 years, but he used to leave home in the early hours of the morning and work. Sorry, he'd walk towards Middlesbrough and try and get a start for the day. And of course, in those days, if they got any pay at all, they lost their dole. So very often he'd come home when the three of us had come home from school and we were sitting down to eat, and Dad would flop down in his armchair and Mother would say, "Come on, Tom, dinner's ready." And he'd say, "I don't feel like eating. I'm not hungry." I didn't know at the time, but since then I've realised that he felt that if he wasn't working, he didn't deserve to eat. They were hard days.
And was unemployment, how did it manifest itself in the area? Was there a problem with crime, or was there problems that people associate maybe today with unemployment?
There was no problem with crime. You could leave the front door open. Your neighbours would look after your house. They'd be popping in to see how you were if they hadn't seen you for a day or two. There was a wonderful community spirit. The big problem on Teesside was drink. If the men got any money at all to help them forget their problems, they'd go and have something to drink. And outside the pubs on dull day, you'd see women waiting, trying to get money off their menfolk. The reason that we always had shoes on our feet was that Dad just gave up smoking and drinking at the time. He loved a glass of beer and he loved his cigarette, but he went without them. The family never really wanted. I was hungry, but I was never starving.
Sounds a very responsible attitude.
My father was one of the most responsible people I've ever known. He always used to say to us, if you can't pay ready cash for something, you can't afford it. And we lived by that. He did. He was never in debt to anybody. I think the war pension for getting gassed was about 2 shillings a week. He couldn't afford to do very much on that.
Were there any ways that he could supplement the income at all?
Only by declaring it, because he would never, ever go behind the rules of the dole. He used to look after and tune up the engines of a man called Dixon, who used to do motorbike racing on the sands at Saltburn and Mask. And my father used to go down there, Freddie Dixon. Dad would tune up his engine for him. Those sands, Saltburn and Redcar, Mask, Saltburn and Redcar, were wonderful. They spread for miles, good hard sand. When the tide went out, it went out nearly a mile, and we had something like a 15 mile stretch of sand. In fact, I was talking to Professor Blackburn, who's the grandson of the original Blackburn, who founded Blackburn Aircraft, and he told me that Robert Blackburn did his first flight in the first Blackburn monoplane at the sands at Redcar. The funny thing is that I knew a fisherman down at Redcar because my brother and I built a seagoing canoe out of an oak frame and canvas covering, like a very streamlined coracle. And we used to keep this in a fisherman's backyard, Redcar. And this fisherman told me that he'd seen the first aeroplane fly. Well, I didn't know what the first aeroplane was when he told me, but he was wrong. It wasn't the it was the first Blackburn aeroplane, which Robert Blackburn crashed, and he very nearly didn't fly again. He very nearly gave it up. But it was just a bit of history.
Given what happened to you in your war service in those early days, did you have any interest in either sea or B, really, aircraft or air aviation, that sort of thing?
Oh, yes. We had a neighbour who was about 5 years older than my brother. My brother was 5 years older than me. And this chap had an interest in anything that flew, anything that sailed, anything that went on wheels. And he was an inspiration. Leslie MacFarlane. He was an inspiration to my brother and myself. When Sir Alan Cobham's Flying Circus came to the district, giving flights for half a crown, we hadn't half a crown, but we used to gate crash the field where he was operating by crawling through hawthorn hedges and ditches and so on, and we used to watch the landing and the taking off of these barnstormers, and we got so interested in it that we then used to go to Thornaby Airfield mainly at the weekends when the weekend Air Force flyers were flying their Hawker Hinds and Whoppertys, and we used to stand and watch these coming and going. In fact, we volunteered to help clean down one aeroplane, and we were accepted, and we had buckets of water and scrubbing brushes and getting the oil traces downstream of the engine, right down the fuselage, the oil streaks. And I suppose they were glad to have somebody to do it. They kept a very close eye on us. But it gave us a lot of encouragement.
What were they like, those early biplanes? Well, pre-war biplanes.
Always giving trouble. Engines misfiring. But the men who were flying them seemed to be able to cope with almost any problem. Their ground crew were wonderful because they hadn't. The only workshop they had was the army bell tent that they brought with them, with the equipment that they brought in the back of an old lorry. I remember the old lorry. It was an old Kleino that they had to wind up at the front. It used to misfire, and yes, happy days.
What about your education? How did that come along?
Well, as I said, we had a class of 56. The reason I remember the number is that when they called the register, instead of calling Jones and Brown and so on, they gave the alphabetical order of children the numbers 1 to 56, and you just called out your number. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It was so much quicker than calling a register. So there were 56 of us in the class. Now, any teacher these days would say it was impossible to teach those children with so many. So varied in their abilities too. We had the full range of children, from children with learning difficulties up to brilliant ones. But the teachers coped. We had a Mr. Faraday who seemed to know just what interested children, and he could get us so absorbed in a thing that we didn't realise we were learning. He was an inspiration. And there was Miss Unthank, who was a bitch on her discipline. She'd cane people almost for the pleasure of doing it, but she held that class in awe, and we learned from her. Everything she taught us was by rote, and things stay with me to this day. At the age of 10, she taught me how to do a square root, how to find a square root by longhand division. I'm not so sure I could do it now, but I bet 20 years ago I could do it. The rate of retention of knowledge has disappeared enormously in the last 20 years, but she taught me things that stayed with me. Out of the class of 56, when it came to the 11 plus exam, which I sat at 10, there were 9 of us. There were 6 girls and 3 boys got the 11 plus. So 9 out of 56. The rest went on to what we call the central school, where they concentrated on mechanical skills. A lot of fitters and turners came out there. A lot of people went into the rolling mills. The girls ended up generally as shop counter girls. But those who passed, 6 girls went to Middlesbrough High School. And of those 6, I know of several who got degrees. 3 got degrees. 2 ended up as headmistresses of schools. There were 3 boys, myself, Ken Walker, and Derek Pennock, all of whom made something of ourselves. Derek Pennock and myself got degrees by starting at night school. Ken Walker ended up in charge of all the goods traffic within a 30-mile radius of York, including Leeds and the marshalling yards at York and so on. But from the same school, in the class ahead of me, we had Raymond Pennock, who became chairman of ICI and was made Lord Pennock. I forget names now. There was another one became head of the civil service. It was a wonderful way of getting out from a dead end. Dandy, come here. So I want to talk about the 11 plus. The 11 plus was a wonderful scheme. It enabled us to get out from a no hope situation and get ourselves up by our own bootstraps. And with parents like mine, they used to insist that you only got anywhere by your own efforts, that you had to put the input to your life and the rest would follow naturally. The school system of 11 plus exams was wonderful for that. It gave no hopers a chance in life, and to have destroyed it the way they have, I don't know, it's unforgivable. I think of all the young people who have potential who are not getting the opportunity. The scholarship was to, I suppose I'm entitled to call it, a fifth-rate public school. Coatham School at Redcar, which had a boarding section, and about 65% of the pupils were paid for, mainly boarders, and made up with the input from schools like mine, day boys, scholarship boys, who usually used to come fairly well at the top of the classes. It was a wonderful system and gave us a chance.
Where were the boarders from, really? Where were they?
They came from all round Durham, North Yorkshire, Cleveland. We had one or two who came from the south. The school had a very good reputation for getting people into Oxford and Cambridge. We used to sit the Cambridge School Certificate exam, and the results were excellent. We had good teachers.
Did you have to wear uniform?
Yes. Yes, we had a uniform which had to be bought from a given supplier, a given shop in Middlesbrough. And that, I think, was one of the curses of the system, because my parents... I remember hearing my parents discussing in the bedroom next door whether they could afford for me to take the scholarship, because at the school there were library funds, we needed rugby boots, we needed games clothes, there were so many expenses. The uniform wasn't the cheapest either, and yet it gave us an identification. We daren't misbehave in the town. We daren't go in the shops and steal the way kids can do these days. We were labelled, and I think it was a very good thing. There was one big snag with the system, which I think is unforgivable. My brother, who was 5 years older than I, was in hospital with appendicitis when the 11 plus exam had to be sat. It was sat on a Saturday morning between 8 o'clock and 12 o'clock. And they brought my brother out of hospital in an ambulance. He sat the exam and then went back into hospital. And he failed the exam, not surprisingly. But because of that, he was condemned to go to the central school, where boys generally went to learn a trade. If they weren't good enough for an apprenticeship, they ended up as labourers. Well, my brother became an apprentice, went to night school, then was going part-time at work and part-time day school, and was in the territorials when war broke out. So he went off very quickly, but he went in as a private and he came out as an acting lieutenant colonel. So he got his chance and took it.
How did your parents afford your uniform and all the bits that went with it?
I don't know. I really don't know how they afforded it, but they never failed to pay it. Mother was adept at making a meal out of very little. Our big treat, I think, was Friday evening when we had bread fried in beef dripping. That was a wonderful meal. Gave us everything we needed, carbohydrates, fat.
Were there any subjects that you really enjoyed while you were at school?
Yes. I had some teachers whom I appreciated for what they were and what they were doing. I used to revel in maths and physics, which were taught by a small chap called Billy Pearson, little Billy Pearson, who taught us everything, all the basics he taught by rote. I can still remember sine, cos, tan, cot, O upon H, A upon H, O upon A, A upon O. I haven't thought of that for the last 30 years, but it's with me because he drummed it into us. He's a wonderful little chap. Chemistry, yes, I used to enjoy chemistry because it gave me the opportunity to produce stinks and do tricks. But the physics was the thing that taught me. I made an induction coil, which from a battery gave a very high voltage, low amperage. And little Billy used to stand by a radiator, leaning against it, and standing on a metal grid where the warm air used to come in. And I connected that up with my induction coil, or shocking coil as we used to call it, and he leaned against it and of course got the full power of the induction coil. I had to own up to it, and I got severe detention, but he took an interest in me. He was that sort of man. He'd give a boy encouragement. The thing I didn't like was the compulsory games on Wednesday afternoon and Saturday afternoon, which was to keep the boarders busy. We had school on Saturday morning from 8 o'clock till 12:30. And we had 3-hour history essay on Sundays to do. We used to get 3 hours homework a night, which was good training for life after the war, life after school. I got my school certificate results on Saturday, the 2nd of September 1939, the day before war broke out. War broke out next morning. I had to make the decision whether I took the minor exhibition that went with my school certificate results, or whether I got out into a job. Having seen what happened to my uncles after the First World War, they were men who had academic abilities, but no practical experience. One with the Military Cross, they were gen people, but they were unemployed after the war and couldn't do anything except take up the land grant in Canada and go out there, and it was a horrendous job, hard, cold, unprofitable. And I didn't want to end up the same way. I thought, if I go to university, I'll be coming out in a war that will last probably 3 years. I'll be coming out with a paper qualification, no practical experience, and I'll be unemployed. And of course it was a big fear, because we'd seen unemployment. We'd seen men standing at a corner with no hope and no interest, no chance of getting a job. I didn't want to be in that position. So I decided that I'd get myself a job and go to night school, and I'd take a London external BSc.